Does the replacement of the hawkish former Prime Minister Stephen Harper with the more progressive Justin Trudeau signal a fundamental shift toward a more peaceful Canadian foreign policy? In what ways is Canada profiting from war? Do the NDP or the Greens represent a principled alternative when it comes to the militarization of Canadian foreign policy? What role do military partnerships such as NATO play in pushing for a militarization of Canadian policy? What is behind the failure of the anti-war movement to address these issues? On this week's Global Research News Hour, we discuss these questions and Canada's involvement in the arms trade with a leading anti-war activist and researcher, Richard Saunders. On this week's program, Trudeau and the Canadian Military-Industrial Complex, a conversation with Richard Saunders. Bringing you the analysis beyond the headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of November 13th, 2015. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. The U.S. Navy's decision to fire off a thermonuclear missile, unarmed or not, into the western skies overlooking Los Angeles was sending a clear, indisputable message to the entire world. By making it such a public spectacle witnessed by hundreds of thousands in America's second largest metropolis, Washington's clear intention was launching another recklessly alarming shot across the bow aimed directly at warning Russia and China to, quote, back off or else, unquote. The range of the Trident II missiles launched is 4,000 nautical miles within full reach of Beijing. What is most evident is that the U.S. government is reacting to Russia and China's challenge to U.S. global dominance as the world's most powerful nation on Earth. The message is clear. Continue challenging America's previously uncontested belligerent rule over the planet, and the U.S. will instigate a global war. That comes from the article, "The War Drums Are Beating. Two Trident Missiles Launched Over Los Angeles, Active Provocation Directed Against Russia and China," by Joachim Hagopian, posted November 11th. What the Russians have provided is an absolutely vital and very daring last-minute temporary solution to a very dangerous situation about to get much worse. They did that knowing full well that they were at a huge political, geographic, and military disadvantage and that their move was extremely risky. I would not say that Putin is risk-averse, but he is certainly very cautious, and for him to have authorized such an operation must have been very difficult. My guess is that what made him decide in favor of this intervention is the correct belief that the Russian forces in Syria are not only fighting for Syria, but that they are first and foremost fighting for Russia. Every Wahhabi Takfiri organization on the planet has already declared a jihad against Russia, and Russia has been fighting these crazies ever since the USA and the Saudis literally federated them in Afghanistan, the brilliant plan of Brzezinski and later Reagan. That comes from the article, "Russia's Intervention in Syria, a Reality-Based Evaluation," by The Saker, posted November 11th. According to a report by Al-Gamener, November 11th, 2015, Israel's Air Force was involved in bombing inside Syria, hitting targets close to Damascus Airport. This report begs the question as to the ultimate objective of Netanyahu's visit to Washington. The Israeli delegation to Washington was also integrated by military and intelligence officials who no doubt had meetings with their counterparts at the Pentagon and Langley, not to mention the U.S. Congress. A week prior to the Obama-Netanyahu summit, Netanyahu dispatched his defense chief, Moshe Bogi Ya'alon, to Washington, quote, to help smooth the way for his own visit, unquote. Was there an understanding that Israel would henceforth play a more active role in the war against Syria? In an earlier statement, Defense Secretary Ashton Carter intimated, quote, "It is a reasonable expectation that the defense relationship with Israel will be one of stability and endurance," unquote, quoted by Defense One, November 3, 2015. Ya'alon was hosted in Washington by Defense Secretary Ashton Carter, who is credited for having stabilized the U.S.-Israel relationship. Were these talks between Carter and Ya'alon behind closed doors indicative of a shift in U.S.-Israel military relations, especially with regard to Syria? That's from the article, "Has Israel's Air Force joined Obama's air campaign against Syria? Israeli jets strike Damascus targets," by Professor Michelle Chalzadovsky, posted November 12th. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Stephen Harper, arguably the most hawkish prime minister in Canadian history, has been replaced by a more progressive-sounding leader, the Liberal Justin Trudeau. He's promised to withdraw Canadian fighter jets from the war theater in ISIS-controlled parts of Syria. But is his military policy likely to be substantively different from that of his predecessor? How extensive is Canada's involvement with international military conflicts? To address these questions, we're joined right now with Richard Saunders. Richard Saunders is coordinator of the Coalition to Oppose the Arms Trade and editor of its magazine, Press for Conversion. He joins me from Ottawa. Welcome back to the Global Research News Hour, Richard Saunders.
Yeah, hi.
So the Liberals said they would withdraw their fighter jets from the war theater during the election campaign, though that hasn't really happened yet. Though they also said that they would support increased military training of fighters on the ground. But in your estimation, how extensive is Canada's role in this military offensive, ostensibly aimed at the Islamic State?
Well, first of all, you're right. They haven't withdrawn the CF-18 fighter bombers. In fact, under the Liberals, the new Trudeau government, they have actually increased the number of airstrikes done by CF-18s. So that's quite interesting, that not only have they not withdrawn these CF-18s yet, they've actually increased the bombing raids by the CF-18s. So just yesterday there was another bombing raid, and Trudeau said that, in coming weeks, they would have an announcement about the withdrawal of CF-18s. Why can't they just withdraw them now? He said in his statement yesterday that they had to be concerned about, coordinating with their allies. That seems to be of more significance, coordination with their military allies in this war, than fulfilling their promises that they made during the campaign, election campaign, and actually just stopping the bombing raids. Mm. It's more important to just cooperate with the Americans, I guess.
Priorities, I guess.
Yeah. So I think what we're seeing is that the Liberals, throughout Canadian history, really, the Liberals and Conservatives are not really that different. You can point to lots of examples of wars that took place, unjust wars that took place under the Liberals. The bombing campaign of the CF-18s in Iraq and Syria now is going to continue for at least the time being. There's nothing really that is stopping them from just saying, okay, as of today, we're not going to do any more bombing raids with our CF-18s. They could just stop it, but they're not.
Yeah. And another policy that was embraced by the Conservatives was this huge sale, a $15 billion deal to sell armored vehicles to Saudi Arabia. I don't imagine you see that changing under Mr. Trudeau either.
No, he said quite clearly during the election campaign, as did the NDP as well. It was similar. They had the same policy, that they would not cancel that deal with Saudi Arabia. It's the apparently the largest export deal in Canadian history. I'm not sure if that's the largest military export deal or the largest deal of any kind. Probably, I guess, it's just the largest military export deal. Anyway, it's huge. To Saudi Arabia, a country, of course, where women are forced to wear coverings, which was a big issue for Harper. Interestingly enough, you know, it's okay to sell billions of dollars worth of military equipment to Saudi Arabia, but, you know, a few women wearing these things in Canada is somehow a major problem that we have to deal with.
Saudi Arabia is also involved in a military campaign in Yemen, which is killing a lot of people.
Right, right. And they've used Canadian these Canadian light armored vehicles, which are equipped with weapon systems as well. They've been used in neighboring wars in the past. Saudi Arabia sent them out to help their neighbors, their other monarchies that are in trouble over there. So it's really disgraceful, the whole military export deal that we're talking about here to Saudi Arabia. But the fact that the Liberals and the NDP did not say that they would, in fact, they said they would not cancel that deal. Another thing, another big military deal that both the NDP and the Conservatives said they would not cancel, the Liberals said they would cancel it, is the F-35, which is the Joint Strike Fighter. It's a most advanced warplane, bomber, fighter, jet that is now in existence or in production. But that, curiously enough, this which has gotten a lot of media attention over the years, this F-35 or JSF, that process was started in 1997 in Canada under a Liberal government. So the Liberals began to help produce and pay for and work towards the purchase of these F-35s back in 1997. And they were in power until 2006. And during that whole period of 9 years, they continued to support and promote and invest in the F-35 program. And then in 2010, the Conservatives, when they were in power, they announced their intention to buy the F-35. So they sort of finalized the deal. But it had been started by the Liberals. And under the Liberals, the Industry Canada, D&D, and Public Works were deeply invested in this thing, and the Liberals spent $150 million on it. In total, by 2015, the Canadian government has spent $310 million. So almost half of the money that was invested in the JSF or F-35 warplane program was done by the Liberals. So for them to come out as the big opponents of this particular weapons program is kind of duplicitous. They both gave equal amounts of money to it and were both supportive of this thing. And now for the Liberals to say, well, we're going to cancel the deal, you know, I think that's just done for appearance's sake. The Liberals like to have the appearance of being and to say whatever they need to say to make people think that they're promoting peace. But in reality, they're just as deeply invested in these things as the Conservatives are, it seems. If you actually look at what they do and not just listen to what they say. And it's disappointing that the NDP didn't say they were going to cancel the F-35. And both the Liberals and the NDP said that they would just, here's our step into the another topic where there's curious realities conflicting with perceptions is to do with the whole issue of military spending. So none of the parties in Canada during the election campaign, even the Greens, so the Greens, the NDP, the Liberals, and the Conservatives all said they would not reduce military spending. Even the Greens, who really, there's no chance that they're going to get elected, they could have easily said that they were going to reduce military spending, but even they wouldn't commit to it.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's not surprising that the Liberals wouldn't commit to reducing military spending, or that the Conservatives wouldn't commit to that, but the NDP and the Greens?
Yeah. I mean, it seems to me...
Very disappointing.
Yeah, the NDP, I mean, back before the election financing laws, and I actually have a question about that in a minute, but before the election financing laws kicked in, both the Liberals and the Conservatives took money from defense contractors, but the NDP did not.
That's
so
correct.
My impression is that the NDP would ipso facto have a more pacifist kind of policy, foreign policy.
I wouldn't say pacifist.
Maybe, but, yeah, you're true, but less militaristic, shall we say.
Well, yeah, one would hope so.
Yeah.
But they're not willing to say that they want to reduce military spending. As they get closer to power and they feel that they are able to possibly win an election, they become more and more like the Liberals or the Conservatives. You're right. During the period from, when I started researching military industry's donations to political party campaigns, election campaigns, was in the 1980s, and through the 80s and the 90s, I can't remember when the law changed, but the Liberals changed it so that corporations couldn't give money directly to candidates during election campaigns. But during that 15 or 20 years where I was researching it, I found that the Liberals and Conservatives received about the same amount from over the years from the military companies. The NDP didn't receive money from military companies, but whether that was because they refused to take it or because the companies refused to give it to them because they didn't think that the NDP were going to win. If the NDP were poised to win, then the military companies would start considering them as a party that they might donate to. And what I would conjecture, and also we've seen when the NDP has won in provincial elections, that they are not enemies of military corporations and military export companies. In Nova Scotia, for example, the NDP premier spoke at the opening of a huge arms bazaar there, the largest military trade show export event, and promoted the military industry. And in Manitoba, the NDP government gave, I think it was $50 million. Yeah, it was $50 million, at least one case of $50 million. Maybe they gave more as well to a big military company there that makes missiles and rockets that are attached to helicopters and warplanes. They always say that, and in Ontario, the same sort of thing happened when we had a Bob Rae as the premier here, the NDP, they didn't divorce themselves from military industry trade show events. The thing is, the NDP has also been a bit disappointing to certain progressives like myself.
Yeah. You know, I was going to ask you the question about, because we know that in the United States, politicians are financed by these defense contractors, with financial donations for their campaigns. And
yep.
I know that used to be the case in Canada, but a decade ago, we brought in election financing legislation that bans corporations from donating directly to political parties.
And unions as well.
And unions as well. And, so I wanted to ask, what would motivate these political parties to promote the interests of these military industries? And it sounds like what you've been saying is that what I gather from what you're saying is that the closer you are to getting to power, the less incentive you have to criticize some of these entities that are seem sort of part of the power base of the country. Is that kind of where
I would say that's true. That's seems to be self-evident. One point that should be made is that although corporations and unions can't give money directly to campaigns anymore, individuals, of course, can. And, you know, changing the law didn't really stop these parties from getting money. They still get as much money, more money, really, than they did before. But you know what? It actually, when the Liberals changed that law so that the companies couldn't give money, it actually made it much harder for people like me who had been 15 years or whatever been researching which companies were giving money to the parties. I couldn't do that anymore because the parties weren't listed. The companies were no longer listed. But you know what? The executives from those companies can still give money. So what you've got is it kind of disguised what was the continuing donations from the military-industrial complex were disguised or covered up. It made it more difficult for researchers like myself to actually track where the money was coming from because, you know, you've got a board of directors of some big company and they don't all have really unusual names. So when you look through the list of donors, I think they listed donors over $1,000. Those were the ones that Elections Canada reported. So if you look at that list of names of donors, you can't necessarily figure out which John Smith it is. Is that the John Smith that's the director of General Motors, or is that John Smith that's my neighbor that, you know, works for he's a custodian at the school or something? You know, you can't. It's taken away a tool that we used to have to track where the money was coming from and where it was going.
Do you think that that might have been deliberate, or is that just sort of an interesting happenstance?
I don't know. I think that they wanted to remove money from that was going to the NDP from the labor unions, and maybe they couldn't do that without also removing the money from corporations. I'm not sure what motivated them. I wouldn't be surprised if the Liberals were motivated by the kind of deception that I'm talking about, that occurred as a result of their policy change.
Now, I know that before we started this interview, you spoke to me about something called the Arms Trade Treaty, and
right.
I'm wondering how that intersects with how that's intersecting with the current policies. Could you talk about that a little?
Yeah, sure. So the Arms Trade Treaty is a UN treaty. It's backed by some of the largest international civil society organizations that are involved in development, human rights, and peace issues. They're household names. Groups like Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch, for example. They're huge. And Oxfam is another one. So they're pretty well-known, huge mainstream progressive organizations that support, and many others, hundreds of other smaller groups. Many of them receive money from their governments. Not all of them, but quite a lot of them do receive financing from their governments. Sometimes, in fact, to do contracts to promote things like the Arms Trade Treaty. So, for example, in Canada, Project Plowshares, which is the largest peace group in Canada, it's mandated by the churches, and it's a pretty prominent. It's the biggest peace group in the country. It's received several hundred thousand dollars from the Canadian government, in fact, during the Harper regime, to promote the Arms Trade Treaty. Although, curiously, the Harper government never signed the treaty. It's one of the few countries in NATO. In fact, it's the only country in NATO that didn't sign the Arms Trade Treaty. So you have this curious situation where, and we have to talk about why it is and come up with our analysis of it. Why is it that the world's largest military producers and exporters are solidly behind a treaty called the Arms Trade Treaty, at the same time as the world's largest peace, development, and human rights groups. So you've got the United States, Britain, Israel, Germany, France, all supporting this treaty. And you've got the largest peace and development human rights groups also supporting the same treaty. Well, the treaty actually only deals with illegal military exports and transfers. It doesn't deal with the bulk of the problem, which is the legal sale of weapons that's happening on a daily basis. So, Canada exports, I don't know, $4 billion worth of military goods to the United States every year. Well, this arms trade treaty will not have anything to do with that. It will not stop, curb, it won't do a thing to deal with that at all. So the vast majority of the military exports in the world are not going to be touched. The reason that the huge weapons-producing countries support this arms trade treaty is because it is a way of controlling the arms trade in a way that they want to control it. It administers, controls this huge complex, the military-industrial complex and its sales abroad and whatnot. It's a way of controlling that. Controlling it doesn't mean that it's going to stop it or it's going to curb it or it's going to reduce it. It just means it's going to control it. So it could be a controlled increase. The treaty very explicitly only deals with illicit or illegal sales of weapons. You know, I'm not saying that I support illegal sales of weapons, not in any way, shape, or form. I don't. But we shouldn't pretend, as some of these large mainstream civil society organizations have very clearly done in their websites and in their documentation about their great work on this arms trade treaty. They make it sound as if they're going to stop. This is going to help stop the arms trade. Well, actually, it's really only stopping a little tiny part of it that is in line with what the imperialist powers that are basically the bulk of the problem. They're helping to control this huge international arms trade in a way that the major arms producers and exporters in the world want them to control it. So it's very interesting problem, because you've got a struggle within peace movements and development movements and human rights movements in different countries. So, for example, the campaign against the arms trade in Britain, which is the largest peace group in the country dealing with the arms trade, it's against the arms trade treaty, and it points out and it criticizes the arms trade treaty in the same way that I have just done. Similarly, in the Netherlands, the largest anti-arms trade group in the Netherlands is also very critical of the arms trade treaty. But then in Canada, you have groups like Plowshares, which is our largest peace group, and the Catholic equivalent, which is Development and Peace. They're both very much in support of the arms trade treaty, and in case of Plowshares, they've actually received hundreds of thousands of dollars from the government to organize discussion groups and workshops and research on this treaty.
Mm. Yeah, sounds.
So, and I know I'm going on and on here, but I'll just say that the Liberals, the NDP, and the Greens are all very much in support of the arms trade treaty and raise none of these critical questions about how it could be that the major weapons producing countries are also supporting the same policy that they are in terms of controlling the arms trade.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca.
I wonder if you could just touch briefly on something, because when you talk just about the illegal sale of weapons, I mean, there was a story just a few days ago about the Iraqi government discovering a shipment of arms for the Kurds.
Yeah.
And that's kind of an interesting development there.
That's another very curious story. So what happened was, under the Harper Conservative government, Canada agreed to start transporting weaponry to these Kurdish fighters who are fighting against ISIL or ISIS. And so we were flying weapons into them. I think it started in July of this year. About 2 weeks ago or 10 days ago anyway, the Liberals were in power at that point. The Iraqi government stopped a Canadian military transport plane, a cargo plane, a C-130, and inspected its cargo and found weapons on board, machine guns, like automatic weapons and semi-automatic weapons and other guns that weren't described, but they gave the names of these kinds of weapons that were being transported. Some of them had silencers. I think there were about 20 of them that had silencers, like silencers on semi-automatic and automatic weapons. And they were being transported, apparently, according to the Canadians, they were transporting these to the Kurds. Or to supporters on the ground in the Kurdish area. So the Iraqi officials, like the government of the country, said these are illegal weapons and these are banned weapons. And they stopped the plane from delivering its weapons, the Canadian plane. They turned it back. It was coming from Kuwait. It was bringing illegal banned weapons into Iraq against the wishes of the Iraqi government. There was also a Swedish plane in the same situation. So it was sent back with its weapons load. So the Iraqi government is stopping Canada from transferring illegal banned weapons into the country. So would that be covered by the Arms Trade Treaty? I guess it would. At least the Iraqis would make that case, but Canada hasn't signed the Arms Trade Treaty. It's very curious. And then when this happened, the Iranian media came out and reported the story, mentioned all the details that I mentioned, plus more than the kinds of weapons, the exact kind of weapons. Oh, curiously, again, to make things a little bit more interesting, is that some of these weapons are either Russian-made machine guns, Russian-made automatic weapons with silencers, or they're Iraqi knockoffs of Russian weapons. Wasn't clear which they were, but they're not weapons made by any NATO countries. These are Russian-made. So why is Canada transferring Russian or Iraqi knockoffs of Russian machine guns with silencers to somewhere in Iraq from outside Iraq? It makes you wonder, is that so that if they are found in the hands of who, I don't know, but if these weapons ever turn up in somebody's hands, they won't be Canadian made. Why weren't they using Canadian made automatic weapons? They're using Russian made ones. Is that so that the Russians are going to then be accused of putting these weapons in the hands of certain people?
It's an interesting hypothesis because Canada is part of that whole gang that's trying to target the Russians as being the imperialists and the expansionists and the bullies and so on. So it seems odd that they would be selling these Russian. It certainly speaks to the idea that Canadian policy, military policy, foreign policy is not rooted in principle.
And it's not what it appears, yeah. Mm-hmm. And now, the Iranian media also did an article that exposed this, then examples of what it said were case examples of U.S.-led coalition forces supporting ISIS and supporting ISIL with weapons, with supplies, dropping them equipment, examples of ISIS forces being found to have NATO-made weapons, and just gave a huge list of examples of ISIS fighters having in their hands NATO equipment, and of U.S.-led coalition forces dropping equipment, weapons, and supplies to ISIS. Now, this is what they're saying. So this, take it with a grain of salt, but we do know from history that the United States has a long tradition of arming fundamentalist jihadist in to be their proxy fighters in wars. I mean, this is an incontrovertible fact. It's not controversial in any way at all. I mean, bin Laden, worked for the CIA, as did a lot of those mujahideen in Afghanistan. They were trusty foot soldiers for the United States, and there's lots of other examples around the world. Also, you have these jihadists that joined the struggle to oust Gaddafi, and you've got lots of examples of jihadists, fundamentalists, Islamists that are fighting in the war basically in cahoots with the United States. So there's a long history of that. There's no denying it. So when Iran says, here's a huge list of examples of this happening again in Iraq, it fits a pattern. And then we've got this thing, this case of Canada actually sending these weapons in, and the Iranian media were suggesting, they were insinuating that this may be another case.
Now, I'm wondering, Richard Saunders, about Canada's partnerships, international partnerships. I mean, Canada's a member of NATO. Canada's a member of the Northern Command. I think there's a specific kind of security partnership with Israel. And I'm wondering if these sorts of partnerships somehow bind the hands of Canadian governments, which leads to this increased militaristic role, or maybe it's the other way around. Maybe certain commercial interests are what guide the decision to go into these military partnerships. Is that anything you can comment on?
Well, when you say that, Canada is bound by these, its hands are tied by these agreements and treaties and arrangements like NATO and NORAD and et cetera, et cetera. The thing is, though, that these are not imposed on us. We've deliberately chosen to join those. We have asked to have our hands tied. The Canadian governments, Liberal and Conservative, have willingly and wittingly joined and supported these U.S.-led military alliances and pacts over the decades. So you can't really blame it on the alliances for, as if they're imposed on us or something. I mean, this is what our government has always wanted. We have the closest working relationship of any country with the United States, like the Canadian-U.S. military closeness, the connectedness, the interoperability is second to none. So there's really the Liberals and Conservatives. The Liberals are in no way saying that they would withdraw from any of those things. For example, when the Liberals said that they would pull out of the F-35 contract, they did that, I believe, for campaign purposes, to make themselves look as if they're more anti-Harper than the NDP, because they want to get elected. But that doesn't mean they're going to withdraw from a military alliance with the United States, or going to reduce military spending. They just said, well, we're going to save money by buying some other kind of weapon system, some other kind of warplane to replace the CF-18. we're just not going to buy the F-35s. We're going to buy some other kind of warplanes to replace these old warplanes that we have that are working to drop bombs in Iraq now. And what we're going to do is we're going to save money, and so what we're going to do is spend it on warships. That's what the liberals said. We're going to spend this extra money that we save. We're just going to save it on. We're going to spend it on warships. And the NDP, you know, they would do the same. They're not going to reduce military spending, so they're going to spend it on other kinds of military equipment. Now, this raises the question of what is the peace movement's role in this? And
yeah,
we have seen examples, disturbing examples, I think, from my perspective, and not just me. I mean, a lot of people, radical types like myself, also are very disappointed with progressive civil society groups, peace groups and whatnot, but come out and basically, like, it's not our role in the peace movement to advise the Canadian government on which kinds of weapons it should buy. Don't buy the F-35s. Just spend the money on refurbishing the CF-18s and buy drones, for example, which was the Rideau Institute's position on this.
That's incredible.
Advising the Canadian government on what kind of weapons are the best deal. I remember this woman that I know, she's died now, but she said to me, and this always impacted me, and I still remember it, she said, "We don't want war, even if it only costs 2 cents." Message that I got from that is, you know, it was not that we want to get the best deal on our military equipment and that we don't want to spend money on war, unjust wars around the world, imperial wars. It's not that we're, you know, and I would go even farther than that and say we don't even want this, even if it makes us money, which it does, of course, and that's why they do it. It makes money. It makes lots of money for us, so that's why we do it.
Well, Richard Saunders, I mean, could you expand on that thought? I mean, what has happened to the anti-war movement? Is this just a question of they've made strategic errors? Or, like, why does the anti-war movement seem to pale in comparison to, say, the climate movement? What insights do you have here? Have they been somehow co-opted, or...
Well, it's a really good question. I think it's a central question that we have to deal with. And I've been trying to deal with it the last few years. It's been a major focus for my research, and I'm writing about it. And I have a theory.
Okay.
So it's very complicated, but I mean, and you have to deal with psychological issues, and you have to deal with social, cultural issues. You have to deal with narratives, the stories. It's easy to say lies and talk about propaganda as if they were lies, but often the best propaganda is propaganda told by people who really believe it. Okay? So, in order to carry out huge crimes against peace or crimes against humanity, in order to carry out genocide, in order to conduct wars, to wage wars or slavery or any kind of huge crimes, doing harm to other people, in order to do those crimes, it's not just, these things are not just done by a small group of psychopaths. Okay, there's just not you need huge institutions. These are institutionalized problems. Now, those institutions are filled with good, well-meaning, decent, honest, sincere people who really believe that what they're doing is helping other people. When in fact, for example, with the residential schools in Canada, I mean, this was genocide. But it was carried out by well-meaning church people who thought they were helping, you know, to advance the civilization, the education of savages, heathens, backward people that needed to be uplifted, and that by depriving them of their language and their religion and their culture and stealing or kidnapping children from their families, they actually believed that they were doing good, most of them. Now, that's not to say that there weren't psychopaths involved in the process. It's just to say that I believe most of the people are actually sincerely believe what they're doing is right. So when I criticize the peace movement for this or that, you know, supporting the Arms Trade Treaty, or another one that's this big problem in the peace movement, I believe, is this whole responsibility to protect doctrine, which is another UN doctrine that is supported by the United States and the world's largest warmongering imperial nations as a way of creating pretexts to wage wars based on humanitarian principles. So they say that they need to go have a military operation to go in there and protect human rights because they're being violated by some dictator or something. But actually, the real reason for the war is some economic reason, and they're going to make billions of dollars out of it. But they can't tell people that, so they have to trick people into thinking that they're conducting these wars or this genocide or whatever it is. They have to trick people into thinking that it's being done for humanitarian reasons, because they rely on huge numbers of people to carry out these things, not only to stand by and quietly acquiesce with folded arms and watch the thing happening, but they actually need people to roll up their sleeves and get involved and to actually do it. Okay, so you need the general public on board to give the taxes and to send the children off to war and to quietly go along with it, but you also need them to actively be involved in administering the programs of genocide and mass murder. But people are generally good, so they don't want to do those things. So you need narratives, you need stories to make people believe that what they're doing is right. And the best people to promote those narratives are the progressive activists. So if you get the progressive activists, the huge civil society, supposedly, I'm putting in quotations here, you don't see my little fingers going up, with the non-governmental organizations, which curiously often receive huge amounts of government money. So why they're called non-governmental is a bit curious. But anyway, they support government programs like Responsibility to Protect, the Arms Trade Treaty, or with the case of the residential schools, that was funded by the government, but it was a civil society organization, the churches, that were administering the program for the government. They're contractors. So we have a situation where civil society organizations, supposedly non-governmental, are actively administering and running and rationalizing and justifying these huge programs, which fall in line perfectly with what the imperial powers want.
This is the first time I think I've heard anybody try to make that connection between the residential schools and this sort of, I don't know, call it a psychological blind spot when it comes to opposing militarism. But a very compelling one. I wanted to touch on one more thing before we close, and that's the role of like one particularly major military contractor is Lockheed Martin, which is behind the F-35 fighter jets.
Right.
And I also happen to know that Lockheed Martin, they were contracted to provide Stats Canada with software for its employees to process its questionnaires in preparation for the 2011 census, and I guess I'm wondering, because, I mean, this is a company that was profiled extensively in the Bowling for Columbine movie. Do a lot of blood on their hands, you might say. I guess maybe you could maybe help our listeners understand what concerns Canada should have, or Canadians should have, with the Canadian government's partnerships with Lockheed Martin.
Well, yeah, it's... The connection with the census is, I must confess, something that I don't know that much about. I mean, I know generally about the topic. I think we do have to be cautious when we're, recruiting or contracting huge war industries to have anything to do with collection of data about people. I guess the contract with Lockheed Martin doesn't involve them actually handling the data, but that doesn't mean that they might not engineer some way to allow themselves to get access to that data. But I think they were just coming up with the programs to process the data, as opposed to actually processing the data. It's just creating the programs. But that said, I mean, I think it is a big issue that we shouldn't give the world's largest arms manufacturer a contract to do something like that. It's the same situation in England, actually. The Lockheed Martin UK, which is a subsidiary of the American contractor, is involved in their census data collection as well, or in the programs, data capture and processing support services for their Office of National Statistics. So, and it may be also the case that Lockheed Martin is doing that in other countries. I'm not sure. But, I'm more focused on Lockheed Martin's role in the F-35s than I am in their involvement with the census. I think we'd need to be skeptical and curious about, watch out for that, and not turn a blind eye to it. The whole problem that I was trying to get at, and it may relate to this question about Lockheed Martin and the census, is that people turn a blind eye to things. They'd rather not know, you know, and that's part of our problem. But the concept in law of turning a blind eye or willful ignorance is very key to this whole process. Okay, so you've got a situation. It's in Britain. It's called Nelsonian knowledge. It's named after Admiral Nelson, who during some battle, he was blind in one eye, and he held his telescope up to his blind eye and looked through the telescope with his blind eye for a signal that he was receiving by flags. He was in a battle in the early 1800s, and he was supposed to receive this signal to tell him to do something, but he didn't want to do it. And he knew what the signal was going to be, or he had very strong reason to believe that what that signal was going to be, but he didn't want to receive the message. So he turned his blind eye to it. So that's called Nelsonian knowledge in British courts. We talk about blind eye knowledge in our court systems, or willful ignorance. So this is when you know something, or you have a good reason to believe that something is the case, but you do not want to look at it, because if you do, then you will have to deal with the not only the legal repercussions, but when we're talking about the peace movement and all these different campaigns that peace activists and human rights activists are involved with, they don't necessarily want to expose themselves to certain facts that will make them realize that what they're doing is wrong. So, for example, with this responsibility to protect doctrine, which is this pretext for waging wars on the basis of humanitarian excuses, we're going to rely on the United States to fight humanitarian wars? This is a ludicrous idea. So what you have to do in order to go along with responsibility to protect, you have to turn a blind eye to the fact that the people who are that you're relying on to wage these peace wars for you are people who have been waging wars for centuries, and they don't do that for humanitarian reasons. They do it for economic reasons or geopolitical reasons, and those are the real reasons why they wage those wars. But you want to convince yourself that you need to have this military operation to give the UN the power to authorize or give a seal or stamp of approval. You know, it's like those fair trade stickers that are on coffee or whatever, right? You put this fair trade sticker on it, and it's a good seal of approval so that an activist or progressive, good, well-meaning person can go along with it. So they're going to come up with these little UN stickers. I'm speaking metaphorically, a UN sticker that you can stick on. on a war, and then people will feel good about fighting that war, whether it's against Libya or Syria or whoever, Iran or whoever the imperial powers want to go to war with. They want progressive people to go along with it, so they need people to turn a blind eye to the reality of what the real reasons are for the war or the arms trade treaty or the whatever the campaign is, whether it's residential schools. You know, you need to be able to assist people in that psychological process so that they can hide from themselves what's going on. So the one other thing, I know we're running out of time, but one other concept here that's important is the idea of plausible deniability, which is where key bureaucrats or leaders within an institution want to hide from the public their involvement in a crime. So they are knowingly involved in a crime, but they want to keep that hidden from other people in the broader society. So they create sort of walls of so that they can plausibly deny that they knew anything about that crime, even though the crime was going on. Well, I didn't know anything about it. Think Reagan and Bush and the Contras and the drug smuggling and et cetera with the Contras. It's the same principle, the same process can be applied on an individual level so that you can plausibly deny to yourself that you had any knowledge of some that was contrary or contradicting what you're doing. So you're promoting a war to help these poor people that are being oppressed by the dictator, but you have to be able to plausibly deny to yourself that there's a problem with this by not looking at, not recognizing, or not dealing with the fact that you're relying on the world's largest imperial powers to fight your war. So you have to kind of push that aside and not look at it and not think about it. And when people raise it, you kind of have to keep looking away from it because you don't want to look at that because it's making you feel bad for, and it might stop you from doing this thing. And if you're in a career path that you know depends on doing a certain course of action, then that makes it even harder to withdraw your support from something that you're so deeply invested in.
Okay. Well, Richard Saunders has very interesting insights, as always. I think we have to close it there. But thank you. Thank you so much for sharing that those thoughts with us and that analysis. And we look forward to future conversations.
Well, thanks. And I hope that what I've said might be useful to people. And when they see certain things happening around them, they might remember what some of the things I said, and they might look at things a different way.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Richard Saunders is coordinator of the Coalition to Oppose the Arms Trade and editor of its magazine Press for Conversion. His website is coat.ncf.ca.
You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.